Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 29th, 2026, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps Decision Program on Ellingberg versus United States, which was decided last week by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Matthew Cavanin, who is the director of the Cato Institute's Project on Criminal Justice. In that role, he focuses on reforming plea-driven mass adjudication, ensuring police accountability, and defending constitutional criminal originalism. His scholarship has been published or is forthcoming in publications, including the Arizona State Law Journal, Cato Supreme Court Review, Seattle University Law Review, and Georgetown Journal of Law and Public Policy. He is formerly a Georgia public defender and a fellow at the Institute for Justice. He has also taught law school courses on criminal law and procedure, as well as the First Amendment. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's program is Sarah Field, who is Chief Counsel of Legal Policy at Koch Capabilities, LLC, where she develops and scales Koch-wide strategic policy initiatives, on a variety of legal, judicial, and regulatory topics. She has formerly led Criminal Justice Reform and Constitutionally Limited Government Initiatives, or Stand Together Community, and worked at Americans for Prosperity. Before that, Ms. Field served as Executive Director for the Center for Shared Services, and she serves on the board for Americans for Public Safety. And I'll leave it there. One last note before I get off your screens. Throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of the Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Cavanin, I'll hand it over to you for opening remarks.
All right. Thank you very much. So the Ellingberg case is a case that asks, should courts treat something as a duck because it quacks and is yellow, has feathers, and spends its time in the pond? Or should courts depend on whether Congress says that something is a duck before treating it as one? So the facts of this case don't, in fact, have anything to do with ducks. Rather, in 1995, Holsey Ellingberg, who's the petitioner in this case, robbed a bank down in Georgia. Coincidentally, the corporation that owned the bank had an office in the very building where I now have some office space with a friend of mine. But Mr. Ellingberg was convicted in not too long after robbing the bank. At the time that he robbed the bank and the time that he was convicted and sentenced, the governing law for restitution was called the Victim and Witness Protection Act. What it said was people can be sentenced to pay restitution, but only for a period of up to 20 years. After that, there's a sort of statute of repose. Liability cuts off. 1 year later, in 1996, Congress amended the law around restitution and passed what's known as the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act. It made two changes that have bearing on this case. First of all, it got rid of that 20-year limitation and kicked out the deadline for paying to 20 years following release. So somebody like Mr. Ellingberg, who got sentenced to several decades in prison under the old act, his liability would have terminated around the time that he got out. Under the new act, though, it didn't even start running. The deadline didn't start running until he was released. So it would be 20 years in the future from then. In addition, the newer statute required the accumulation of interest on restitution. Congress, when it passed the act in 1996, the new act, appears to have anticipated that there would be an ex post facto challenge to the law. It included language saying that the changes would be retroactive only, quote, to the extent constitutionally permissible, end quote. We'll call that foreshadowing. Mr. Ellingberg was sentenced to nearly 27 years in prison and to pay $7,500 in restitution. Over the course of the first 20-year stretch of his imprisonment, he paid about $2,000. Folks in prison don't make a whole lot of money to begin with. They're also charged other expenses by prison and otherwise. So he didn't make a ton of progress. He took out about a third of what he owed to the bank. Mr. Ellingberg was ultimately released about 3 years ago and is trying to rebuild his life at this point. But probation says that he still owes $100 monthly payments toward restitution and $13,476.01 total because of the addition of interest. So at this point, if the new law applies, requiring the accumulation of interest and that longer deadline, Mr. Ellingberg is going to be paying for some significant time headed into the future. He also, at this point, owes almost twice as much as he was sentenced to pay initially, even after making the $2,000 or so of payments over that time. So Mr. Ellingberg brought a challenge under the ex post facto clause, said that this was a retroactive increase in the penalty for his crime. The district court said the changes that the law made did not, in fact, increase the punishment. So there was no violation of the ex post facto clause. What the district court was saying was extending the time period to pay restitution and even including interest in calculating it, those don't increase punishment. That is actually not the holding that the Supreme Court's case ended up being about, because the Eighth Circuit ended up coming up with a more radical way of approaching the case. The Eighth Circuit said criminal restitution is not even criminal. There's a category error applying the ex post facto clause to it. The ex post facto clause only applies to criminal punishments. Criminal restitution isn't criminal punishment. It's a civil matter. Two out of the three panel members from Mr. Ellingberg's case at the Eighth Circuit concurred, criticizing their own circuit's precedent and saying it's kind of weird that we don't treat criminal restitution as criminal punishment, but our hands are tied. This should be reviewed en banc. The Eighth Circuit disagreed and did not take up the case en banc. So Mr. Ellingberg asked the Supreme Court to grant cert. The court did grant cert. Shortly after that, Mr. Ellingberg got a huge boost. The United States decided to file in support of Ellingberg and not defend the Eighth Circuit's decision. The United States believed that the district court had gotten it correct, that the expanded deadline for paying and the addition of interest do not increase punishment. But the federal government disagreed with the Eighth Circuit that criminal restitution is not, in fact, criminal punishment. So they asked the Supreme Court to reverse the case and to remand. John Bash was appointed as an amicus in defense of the Eighth Circuit's decision. I wrote Cato's amicus brief, which was joined by the Fines and Fees Justice Center. We urge the court to look at the whole picture of how criminal restitution works and find that it is, in fact, punishment. The Supreme Court issued its decision. It was a unanimous decision. It was very brief. Justice Kavanaugh wrote a 5-page opinion for the majority, just 5 pages. What it said was, as a matter of statutory interpretation, the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act matches a lot of the characteristics of criminal punishment. It sounds like criminal punishment. The statute describes it as punitive and having punitive purposes. It uses terminology that lines up with criminal punishments. It also requires restitution to be imposed after a criminal conviction. So without a conviction, there is no criminal restitution. You have to have a conviction in order to trigger restitution. In addition, that restitution is imposed as part of the sentence during a sentencing hearing with all of the normal protections that apply to other aspects of criminal punishment. And if that's not enough, should somebody fail to pay restitution, the punishments are addressed criminally. People can get sent back to prison. They can have their supervised release revoked, things like that. The majority opinion said, you put all of that together, and it is a clear indication that Congress meant for criminal restitution to be treated as criminal. Therefore, it is covered by the ex post facto clause. The court remanded the case for the United States to be able to pursue its other arguments that interest and the deadline changes did not actually increase the punishment. There was some disagreement among the court in spite of the unanimity of the opinion. Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch issued a separate concurrence written by Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas says, the majority appears to be starting from the wrong place here. Ever since Calder v. Bull, a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 1798, the Supreme Court has said that the ex post facto clause applies to criminal punishments. Legislative, quote, labeling or semantics, end quote, isn't the point. The point isn't that Congress tailored the statute, drafted it in such a way that this feels like criminal punishment. Rather, it's a functional analysis. What Justice Thomas said was, looking at history, at the time Calder came down, criminal punishment just meant, quote, any coercive penalty for a public wrong, end quote. There was no multi-factor statutory interpretation test. There was no adding up eight different features of a bill and saying, yeah, this seems kind of criminal. Rather, if there's a coercive penalty and it's for a public wrong, then that's enough to trigger the ex post facto clause. Justice Thomas talked about what a public wrong looks like. He said, William Blackstone's commentaries actually have two separate books, one entitled Private Wrongs, one entitled Public Wrongs. There's four books in total, but those are the two that are relevant here. Public wrongs are those that go against the public welfare of the community. It's not just a private dispute. Justice Thomas also mentioned Calder itself. Calder v. Bull was a fight where Connecticut amended its rules about who would inherit if somebody died intestate without a will. And there was a fight between surviving family members over who would inherit an estate before and after that law was enacted. The court said the ex post facto clause wasn't triggered by that because fights over wills aren't criminal punishment, and nobody was being punished by losing that lawsuit. That was a private dispute, not a public concern. So what Justice Thomas's test is look, if this thing quacks like a duck, who cares what Congress said? We have historical judicial rules from precedent that tell us when the ex post facto clause applies, and Congress can't get out of that using creative drafting. The broader context of this, the justices actually just disagreed a couple of weeks ago on a very similar interpretive question. How much weight do we put on statutory interpretation, trying to figure out what Congress did, versus how much are we looking at definitive constitutional rules that the courts come up with? Listeners may remember a few weeks ago the double jeopardy decision, Barrett v. United States. In that case, the majority said, Congress looks like it doesn't mean to punish twice the same act of possessing a gun under certain circumstances. Justice Gorsuch that time wrote and said, look, Congress doesn't get to override constitutional protections, he said in his separate opinion. This isn't a drafting game, especially in the age of overcriminalization and weakly worded, loosely worded federal criminal codes. We're talking about core constitutional provisions here. We're asking whether things that duck, things that quack and have yellow feathers are ducks, not whether Congress says that they're ducks. There appears to be some real disagreement between Justice Gorsuch and, at least in this case, Justice Thomas as well, and some of the other members of the court on stare decisis and deference and following Congress's lead versus having the court put its first foot forward and say, look, these are the constitutional rules. Congress has to work within the constraints of those. These are hard and fast limits on what Congress can do, not just drafting instructions for Congress. Of note, Justice Thomas did not join Justice Gorsuch's separate opinion in Barrett, but he did write this separate opinion in Ellingburg. There could be implications beyond just this one statute passed in 1996 and anybody who's still paying restitution from before then. Justice Thomas says, if we're going to define criminal punishment as any coercive penalty for a public wrong, that includes a whole bunch of things like punitive civil fines, administrative enforcement when people are getting hit with penalties that accrue by the day, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars of them, like in Sackett v. EPA a couple of years ago. Justice Thomas said also municipal tickets for speeding, things like that. Those are coercive penalties for public wrongs. He said criminal protections should apply to cases even if they're kind of quasi-criminal or nominally civil. How far is the court going to go with that? We don't know. How far is Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch? How far are they willing to go? We don't know. Cato's brief went a little bit farther than speeding tickets. Cato's brief said that the court should reconsider whether things like sex offender registration, civil asset forfeiture, and other kinds of heavy quasi-criminal or civil penalties can count as criminal punishment. There's also a question of what other contexts can that civil versus criminal distinction apply to? If criminal protections, including your right to an attorney, your right to a jury trial, all of those things now apply whenever there's a coercive penalty on the table for some public wrong, the petty offense exception to the jury trial, right, which says you don't get a jury trial unless you're facing a crime carrying more than 6 months of jail time, might be on the chopping block. There might be a whole variety of contexts around the right to counsel, maybe even search and seizure protections that would apply as well. This case in its immediate reach is going to be pretty limited. I don't know how many people were sentenced before 1996 to pay restitution and are still paying it and wouldn't be able to based on the new schedules and the new interest accrual. But if at least some of the justices are thinking that this sort of weird administrative state type no man's land of it does really bad things to your life, but we're not going to treat it as criminal. If there's some skepticism about that, then there might be a lot more precedent coming in for questioning. We'll see. Or maybe this will just be a swan song by Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch, and other justices won't get on board with it. We'll have to find out.
Yeah, a lot remains to be seen. Thank you, Matthew. Let's go into the broader context and the potential implications in a little bit. But first, as you were reading through the opinion, it's short, as you mentioned, it's just about five pages. Was there anything in there that you were surprised to see raised by Justice Kavanaugh? Was there anything that you just didn't expect to see there in the main opinion?
I think the big surprise for me was that the court was satisfied by saying, look, this statute has like seven or eight of these characteristics. If you put them all together, it's definitely criminal punishment. Cool. How much guidance is that worth? I mean, almost no other statute is going to have these exact characteristics and this exact weight and this exact posture. That was something that Justice Thomas dinged as well, saying, like, this isn't what the Supreme Court probably should be doing. Like, this isn't clear guidance. All that it says is, look, in this one case, we're satisfied that it's on one side of the line. I'm a little bit surprised that the court seemed satisfied to just kind of toss up its hands at that point and walk away without getting into some sort of broader principle. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that the court was bugged by the Eighth Circuit's quite radical decision here, but it's easy enough to say, well, this is the craziest thing imaginable. This is as far out as it can possibly get. This is bad. Okay. And now what? How are you going to cite that in any brief that doesn't involve the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act? Or better yet, how are you going to cite it in a way that the other side can't just turn around back on you and say, ah, this time only four of the five characteristics were there, so it should come out the other way? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, the list is an interesting one because it's really a mix of sort of statutory, like key pieces of the statute and then prudential considerations, right? So as you're saying, it's like, well, you know, how can you actually replicate this in any other situation? It's hard to tell. You mentioned Justice Thomas's concurrence and his agreement with many of the arguments in Cato's brief. And one of my favorite lines in his concurrence is when he says that the court's current approach, right? So what we just talked about to defining criminal punishment turns, quote unquote, largely on legislative labeling has little basis in history, and is unnecessarily convoluted, like we were just discussing. So can you give us a little more context on his perspective and why he places so much weight on Calder in determining whether a law is criminal or whether it's civil in nature?
Absolutely. Justice Scalia once said that he wasn't quite Justice Thomas. He said, Justice Thomas, he's an originalist. Scalia said, I'm a faint-hearted originalist. There is some sense there in which Justice Thomas has never been a big fan of constitutional stare decisis. That's an understatement. Justice Thomas has made it clear he doesn't think there's a whole lot of weight at all to give to constitutional stare decisis. So he would have no qualms with saying, regardless of what the court may have said, regardless of any of those issues, frankly, regardless of whatever Congress wants to do in terms of how it drafts legislation, forget all that. We've got tests. We're an independent branch of government. The Constitution's binding on us. Let's go back and find the original meaning. Calder v. Bull has a lot of significance because 1798, my goodness, how often is anybody citing any Supreme Court case with 17 at the front of it, right? That's as early as you get as far as binding precedent goes. Calder v. Bull was very close in time to Blackstone's commentaries into that rich vein of English common law tradition that the framers looked to in crafting the Constitution. So I think a lot of the reason was it is historical pedigree to the umpteenth degree. It's a very strong argument for originalism that, look, a case authoritatively coming out right around that time that follows closely from common law, that applies common law type reasoning to issues around the time that the constitutional provision is being drafted, that is probably a faithful interpretation of what the state of the law was at that time. So Calder and its reflection of the same kinds of ideas that informed Blackstone, which in turn informed the framers, I think is why he has that interest. It is worth mentioning, Calder v. Bull comes up fairly often in other legal disputes because it describes its holding in terms of natural justice. The Calder court did not spend a lot of time parsing the language of the Constitution. Rather, it said there are certain things that are just so inequitable and unjust that a free, orderly, rule-bound legislature could not legitimately pass them. Calder v. Bull reflected an appreciation for natural rights, not just constitutional interpretation, but natural rights. It predates the more positivist approach, which would say, look, the rights that we have are given to us by the Constitution, and so we've got to look at that text in order to figure out what they are. The Calder approach is more of the Constitution recognizes certain pre-existing norms of justice that no government can legitimately infringe, right? Those inalienable rights that the Declaration of Independence talked about. Happy America 250, everybody. It's 2026 now. So I think that's something that Justice Thomas is alluding to as well. Justice Thomas has written about how he thinks that the Declaration of Independence actually should have a role in jurisprudence as well, that courts should see it as informing the state of the law. I get the sense Justice Thomas may be more open to natural rights type arguments than certainly Justice Scalia would have been with his concerns about judicial overreaching and stare decisis and things like that. Hadley Arkus, I will say, who's a professor of philosophy who writes a lot on jurisprudence, wrote an analysis of Ellingberg recently where he said that he thought that Ellingberg stopped just shy of voicing a really natural rights focused analysis of the ex post facto clause. He thought that Justice Thomas stopped a little bit short of the finish line there. Now, Professor Arkus is very much an advocate for using natural rights reasoning. He said, wouldn't it be easier if we just asked whether or not something that a legislature was doing is justified? As a litigator, I'm not sure I agree with that. I've worked with judges before. One of the realities of pluralism and of legal debate is lots of people think things are justified, and constitutional rules help to cabin what it is that we're talking about and put limits on those arguments. Still, I think he's on to something there, which is that Justice Thomas, by relying pretty heavily on Calder, is gesturing at a tradition that predates written constitutions and enumerated rights.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. So the opinion focuses so heavily on this specific statute, as you mentioned, that I think it's easy for a lot of folks to sort of, you know, look at it quickly. So this doesn't apply to me. They might not even go to the concurrence. And so it's easy for them to overlook the broader implications of what could happen if the arguments in the concurrence really start to get traction. And so could you unpack what some of those broader implications could be?
Absolutely. I think there's two directions that Ellingberg could lead in the future. One is, how does Ellingberg redefine what counts as criminal versus civil? That means that a whole number of different constitutional provisions could come into play. When we have a criminal case, there are all kinds of parts of the Bill of Rights that suddenly get triggered. Your right to have an attorney represent you, including at no cost if you cannot afford one. Your right to have a trial by a jury rather than a judge. Your right to confront witnesses against you. A number of evidentiary protections, double jeopardy, excessive fines, all of these different protections kick in once we're in criminal land. The problem is there's been this big middle ground canyon that the Supreme Court has approved of over and over again, where things that involve lifelong consequences and heavy restrictions on personal liberty, and that certainly seem punitive, they look backward to, did you do something bad? If so, we're going to do this thing to you in order to rehabilitate you, in order to deter you, in order to commit retribution and retaliation against you. The Supreme Court has said that everything from seizing an airplane that you own because they think that it was used to run drugs, to making you register as a sex offender for the rest of your life and not be within 500 yards of a school or church, things like that. The court has said that these are civil. And so you don't get all of that full suite of protections. Instead, you just get plain Jane old civil procedure protections. The government might just have to prove something by a preponderance of the evidence. If Congress wants to create some sort of jury mechanism, cool. If not, no big deal. If they want to kick it to an Article I court instead of an Article III court, they can do that. So if Ellingberg is taken in its more radical strand in the way that Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch seem to indicate, then a whole lot of those other things could come into play. Another possible direction that Ellingberg could go in the future is, well, what if we just play with the issue of money? What if we take a narrower approach here? Ellingberg said restitution that's owed to a victim is part and parcel of a criminal case. Oftentimes, though, fines are not. So even if you have an agency that's running hearings, I'm thinking of the Sackett v. EPA case that was litigated at the Supreme Court over the course of a number of years. The EPA believed that the Sacketts out in Idaho had violated rules around clean water. They started accruing fines at a clip of like $10,000 a day, I think it was. If I recall correctly, the ultimate fine ended up being like seven figures by the time that it got to the Supreme Court. If we start treating that, even though it's from an administrative agency, even though it's found in a civil statute, even though it lacks many of the trappings of a criminal law, even though you can't go to prison for violating it, if it is still a coercive penalty imposed for some public wrong, which it certainly sounds like it is, then there might be a lot of tools for people challenging the administrative state that comes out of Ellingberg. It's ironic. Most people would think you don't want to get hit with some sort of criminal charge or criminal accusation. But as a litigant, you oftentimes want all of the shields that come from being in criminal law land rather than civil law land. So if there's some openness to pushing more cases across that line, that could provide more and more opportunities for litigants who are facing government pressure.
Yeah, Matthew, that's super helpful. I know you have some background on fines and fees issues. I wonder if it might be helpful. A lot of our listeners may not have sort of the day-to-day experience with the justice system. So the examples you gave were sort of big examples, but day-to-day, somebody, you know, is no longer incarcerated, they come back to society, what are the types of fines and fees that we're talking about here? How common is that?
I think the best way to think about it is just look at what happened with Mr. Ellingberg. He's in prison for a 20-year stretch and ends up serving more years than that. Over the course of those 20 years, he pays a grand total of $2,000 toward restitution. That's not because he's lazy, nor is it because the prison wardens aren't letting him pay restitution, right? It's because when you are doing prison labor, even if you're doing it diligently, there's no minimum wage protections. There's no unionization. There's none of those things. There's either sit in your cell or go make furniture and stamp license plates. And oftentimes it is paid at cents on the dollar. In addition, facilities can charge people for all kinds of things. There's been a lot of back and forth between the Biden administration and the Trump administration about fees for using phones to call outwards. Some of the providers may charge $30 or $40 a minute to have a phone call with somebody. Commissary fees. Your Pop-Tarts are not the same price that they are at Walmart. So if you want to be eating anything other than gruel, you may need to pay for that. Some facilities charge people for their clothing, charge them sort of room and board type things. People may also have fines that are assessed as part of their criminal case. And then when you finally get out of all of that, first of all, you have a felony conviction now. And for Mr. Ellingberg, he's got a violent felony conviction involving robbing a bank. So finding another job is going to be difficult. You're also trying to adjust to a whole world of mental health and physical health problems that are often exacerbated by being in prison. It's a stressful place. Prison medical care is often subpar. So there's a number of difficulties that can come to adjusting and to getting gainful employment back. In addition, though, there's monthly fees for everything from getting drug tested as part of supervised release to paying your supervised release officer to all of these things. Different systems charge different amounts, but there's a lot of costs. If you have to put on a GPS monitor, you might be responsible for paying for that, which could be another $100, $150 a month, things like that. So there are all these other expenses that come. Restitution, one might think that it's fair to burden the government with bearing some of the costs of the penalty side of it, right? As far as having to drug test and things like that. Restitution, I mean, that's something that a victim is owed. A bank may not be the most sympathetic victim in the world, but it is a real victim. And certainly the people who hold monies in it are real victims. But also in other cases, that money might be owed to somebody who suffered personal violence against them. You might think that that means that they would get put to the top of the pile as far as who gets paid back first, but that's oftentimes not the case. I do see a question. I know we're getting to questions and answers in a bit, but about whether the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act applies to states. It does not, but the ex post facto clause does. So the exact timing of the federal change in deadlines and in interest, that's limited to the federal government. But the decision in Ellingberg could have an effect on other sorts of state level constitutional issues that come up. Restitution fines and fees can be a real hurdle for people being able to reintegrate. In the worst cases, those kinds of money pressures, if they push somebody back into crime in order to cover the costs of everything, plus child support, plus mortgages, plus medical payments, plus everything else, they can be counterproductive. And that can be a dangerous thing by incentivizing fresh crimes, which means fresh victims, which means other people who may or may not ever get paid back.
Right. That's very helpful. Thank you. We have another question in the chat from Kenneth Landers. You mentioned the double jeopardy clause. The other clause I'm thinking about here is the excessive fines clause. In Tyler versus Hennepin County, Gorsuch and Jackson wrote a short concurrence reminding lower courts that excessive fine protections don't turn on legislative labels, but whether the statute at issue serves in part to punish, following Austin. The general observation is that lower courts are refusing to apply excessive fines protections unless the law is criminal. Do you think Thomas's reasoning could be applied to resolve the confused application of the excessive fines clause as well? Or are the reasons not to bar an analytic framework from the ex post facto clause for excessive fines purposes?
That's a very good point, and I'm curious to see whether this just becomes a theme for Justices Thomas and Gorsuch, and maybe Jackson as well, is are they willing to say that, look, this entire middle space of civil-like pains in the butt from the government are in fact criminal for constitutional purposes. That would certainly simplify things. I think part of the reason there's been a lot of pushback from lower court judges is the more protections you have, the harder it becomes to administer a lot of these cases, right? It does involve a lot more due process than do civil cases. So I think that's part of the reason why courts that already have very, very busy dockets are perhaps a little bit hesitant to put more things in that box. We're going to have an opportunity to see more thinking from the justices on this pretty soon. There's a case, Pung v. Isabella County, where a county had a civil judgment against somebody, I think it was a tax deficiency, and mortgaged off the home in a foreclosure proceeding, but then kept all of the overage money. And the court's going to be taking that up pretty soon. So I think we're going to see, again, that's a little bit farther away from the criminal context. But if Isabella County makes any kind of noise about how they did this for some public interested reason, rather than just as part of a private dispute between them and the taxpayer, similar issues might arise. Maybe not. Maybe foreclosure really is enough of a separate universe. But if the county starts talking about the need to deter people who are absconding on taxes and things, this might raise some more questions. I don't know. We'll see.
Another question we have in the chat is, do you really need this specific statute, the MVRA, in order to impose restitution as part of a sentence?
So statutory restitution exists because restitution's always been available in the civil context. Somebody could bring a tort suit for something that happened. The bank that Mr. Ellingberg robbed could absolutely have filed a civil case and pursued that against him. Congress introduced federal criminal restitution statutes in part to streamline things so that there wouldn't need to be dual litigation, especially when there's already res judicata and issue preclusion. If you lose your criminal case, you're very likely already done with most of the elements on the civil side of things as well. So Congress passed this in order to try to add more tools to provide restitution. The Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, one of the changes at issue that didn't apply in the Ellingberg case is, as the statute says, it made restitution mandatory. So Congress started by letting district judges impose restitution. It then made the judgment call that not enough judges were doing it voluntarily as part of sentencing, and that there were overriding public reasons to impose restitution as a mandatory part of criminal punishment. That is, in fact, another reason why this case ended up coming out on the criminal side of the line, is because it's a mandated part of criminal sentencing at this point. But as far as whether that was a reasonable judgment call in light of all of the other policy concerns and people's indigence and other things like that, I don't know. I haven't looked a whole lot into the history of how restitution came about. It was made mandatory all the way back in 1996, so it's been on the books for quite a while now. I do think that restitution in general reflects that public harms, certainly when they involve private victims, have private harms as well. I think that's an important perspective for the criminal justice system. I do think that there's an appropriate role for victims' voices, interests, and rights to come into play. And I do think that restitution is an appropriate part of that. Weighing that out among all of the other concerns with allowing people to rehabilitate and to pay off their debt to society appropriately, as well as the government's interest in recouping some of its money, that's tough. My gut sense is that victims' interests should probably come before government's bureaucratic ones in recovering the costs of supervision. But I also think that needs careful tailoring, given the fact that it's in everybody's interest if people who've been convicted can at some point successfully reenter society and feel like they've truly paid off their debts and they can move on, and so can society. Mm-hmm.
So a question about sort of this court's approach to criminal issues. So the court did take several criminal law cases this term, but over the past couple of terms, there's been a pretty significant drop in the number of criminal cases that the court has been taking. And so as we're looking at this reduction in the court's criminal docket, what does this case tell us specifically about where the court might be going? What is the court's approach to criminal cases?
One of the things that I am hoping that the court is signaling this term, especially, is that it is willing to look beyond the core example of what you would think of as a criminal trial case. It is remarkable that even though something like 96% of convictions at this point come from guilty pleas rather than trials, the Supreme Court has still only granted a smattering of cases about plea bargaining. It is also remarkable to me that even as you have this whole universe of sort of criminal-ish stuff, and I'll add involuntary commitment to the pile as well, since we're filing a brief on that next week too, the court still tends to think of its work in the criminal law space as, let's see if somebody's trial rights are violated in a full criminal proceeding. Ellingberg, I think, made a smart call of looking beyond just the trial setting. The court also is considering the interpretation of the First Step Act and some of the punishment type aspects of criminal cases. And in the case of Hunter v. United States, which is going to be argued in March, it is decided to grant cert on a case about the scope of waivers of appellate rights during plea negotiations. I am hopeful that a couple of these cases show that the court is aware of what modern criminal law often looks like, that it's not always going all the way through to trial and then having full due process and what are the contours of that, but rather that there's this whole other galaxy of stuff that ends up happening a lot more often than a full-blown trial, where the court has not spelled out a ton of constitutional constraints. We'll see whether that's just a trend or whether that's just the fluke of this year. But I'm hoping that it means that the court is going to wrestle with this system in a similar way as it has other aspects of kind of the administrative state.
I remember an interesting exchange during Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing about plea bargaining. And I would commend that to folks to go back and look at that exchange. And it seems that he's certainly aware of the issues. So now that we have a decision, what questions remain unanswered? Are there any that remain unanswered from the posture of this case?
There's a huge one. There's a reason it was a remand in this case. And there's a reason the United States chipped in on Mr. Ellingberg's side, but only very conditionally. They said, we disagree with the Eighth Circuit's ruling, not we disagree with the district court's ruling. The district court approached this case from a completely different angle and just said, even assuming that restitution, I don't know if the district court made a ruling on whether or not restitution is punishment, but it just said, look, extending the timeline that somebody has to owe restitution and attaching interest to it, those just aren't increases in punishment, setting aside the criminal question entirely. The Eighth Circuit never reached those issues because it said, oh, no, this isn't even criminal in the first place. What are you doing here? There's no ex post facto problem at all. So now the court's going to have to wrestle with, the Eighth Circuit's going to have to wrestle with, all right, this is criminal. Ex post facto applies. Now, does kicking out the timeline and increasing the amount of dollars owed, does that violate the ex post facto clause? And Sarah, I have to be honest, that is a question that I will need to explore if we decide to write an amicus brief again on that point. I haven't dug deep into all of the jurisprudence around that.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting, right? What is the definition of punishment? Justice Thomas says in his concurrence that it's any essentially traditional deprivation of life, liberty, or property, any that redresses the public wrong. And so his definition of public wrong is obviously, you know, pretty expansive. And now this definition of punishment is very expansive. So it'll be interesting to see if that concurrence starts to gain traction and sort of what this looks like as this goes back down. So it is a big open question.
And there are some analogs when a state, say, extends the statute of limitations for a crime after somebody's already committed it. there is some precedent on that. You want to talk about complex areas of law, though. That's another one where perhaps the court will end up with this case back again and another chance to try to clear out some of the brush of messiness.
Well, I have one last question, which is who should be paying attention to this decision, right? What kind of actors in the system should be looking at this, thinking about the possible indirect effects? Who should those folks be?
That's a great question. Certainly judges should when it comes time for sentencing. But again, the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act has been in place for so long at this point that it's usually on their radar. I would say that this case in particular is going to impact the most folks who've been in prison for a long time and or on supervised release for a long time, folks who may have had life sentences or sentences of several decades and are now out and still have to pay, say, $100 a month or something like that. They now have a tool for being able to argue that that should not continue to be imposed. The addition of interest as well. I mean, I think one of the more surprising optics of this case is in 2026, Mr. Ellingberg owes almost twice as much money as he did in 1996. Now, granted, part of that's the fault of the Federal Reserve and of a number of stimulus checks and various other things, right? That's inflation for you. But for folks who are in that position and folks who work with people who have limited means and may have interacted with the justice system, as well as folks in states where there's been changes to restitution laws, those are the folks who should be paying the most attention to this case on its own terms and looking to see whether there might be a way to get relief. On the flip side, victims as well may want to consider whether they should file a civil suit or do something else to secure their rights in the event that government restitution is not going to be forthcoming.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I don't see any additional questions. I see one that just popped up. Would you say that the facts of this case limit its impact? That is to say, there would be no ex post facto issue for people charged post MVRA because the MVRA has been law since 1996 and everyone has notice.
Yes. And the fact that I spent 2/3 of this courthouse steps talk opining about the wonders of a 2-judge concurrence, I think tells you most of what you need to know, which is the majority opinion here, 5 pages long, is almost extremely limited to the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act. The Mandatory Victim Restitution Act is about as old as Lion King is at this point. You're right. There's not so many folks who are still paying restitution under it who are caught in this in-between space. And if the courts ultimately decide that extending the deadline and increasing the interest don't count as punishment, there may not even be a difference at all for folks like Mr. Ellingberg. So yes, limited is a great way to put it. Philosophically delightful is another way to put it if you want to be more optimistic.
Okay. Well, Matthew, thank you so much. Any last words on your part?
Thank you all for joining. And for anybody out there who's got one of these cases, I'd be super interested to hear how things go on the next stage if somebody does have somebody who's been directly impacted by this.
Well, I'll echo those thanks. I really appreciate you both taking this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight. It was a really interesting discussion, and we really appreciate you joining us. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.